You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow night, candidates to be Wisconsin's next governor are set to debate, and you can hear it live on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate starts at 7 o'clock. Listen to an hour of debate plus analysis after it wraps. That's tomorrow here on WPR and online at WPR.org. Now, do you consider yourself a nerd? Maybe you're a big superhero comic fan, or you love to geek out to Harry Potter fan fiction. Our next guest loves a wide variety of what we could call nerd culture, and she says it deserves the same level of cultural analysis and criticism that we usually think about for things that are, you know, more highbrow, a fancy art house film or prestige television. She shares that love in a new book, along with a look at how nerd culture takes on things like race, sexuality, and mental health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you nerd out about? What do those movies, books, TV shows, comics, you name it, mean to you or add to your life? Do you feel like you're part of a community, a fandom for some particular pop culture? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maya Phillips is a poet, author, and critic at large for the New York Times. Her new book is Nerd, Adventures in Fandom, From This Universe to the Multiverse. She's appearing at the Wisconsin Book Festival tomorrow at 9 p.m. at the Madison Public Library Central Branch. Maya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Can you share your origin story a little bit? Where did you first start to love nerd culture?
Oh my gosh. It has always been a part of my life. I don't even know. I mean, even from when I was a child, from a very young child, I remember I was just watching like early anime. Like I remember I watched Speed Racer when I was still in diapers. Like I was watching early anime from elementary school. I was watching Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon, and I was into Harry Potter when it came. You know, it has always been a part of my identity. And I just... It's interesting to see how it's become so mainstream now.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, but I want to get into this idea. I think this is really central to a lot of your essays here. We think sometimes, okay, yeah, the serious criticism we're going to do for the fancy stuff. This is like escapist entertainment. We don't really need to engage with it that carefully. Why is it important to you that we do that?
It's important because these fandoms reflect who we are, what we believe culturally, what we believe individually. And it, you know, like people, there's a reason why people get up in arms about the representation in their fandoms, or like how things are portrayed, the politics of it. If you look at these fandoms, you can see a swath of what we believe as a culture and what we value. And I think that's really important.
I think sometimes a reaction to this kind of look is, just given the way the internet works now, is I love this thing, and if you're engaging with it and you say something bad about it, you know, we're on opposite sides. There's this like us versus them sort of thing. You clearly, in a lot of the pop culture you write about it, you might see concerns and problems. We'll talk about that, and yet you still love the thing. How can we separate out that, you know, yes or no, us against them mentality?
You know, I wish there were a better solution than, guys, you just need to chill out a little bit. Because I do get it a lot. Whenever I write an article on a beloved fandom, something that I even love, like Avatar, The Last Airbender, I wrote about that and people were upset because I was analyzing it. And I think there just needs to be a better understanding that the reason why I'm analyzing it, the reason why I'm taking the time to think through these thoughts and to, you know, go through each episode or like sit through the movies once, twice, however many times, is because I do care about this. And I do care about how this art can be improved.
We're talking to Maya Phillips. Her new book is called Nerd, Adventures in Fandom, From This Universe to the Multiverse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be a nerd? If so, what for? Is there one particular thing you're really into? Are you a dabbler like me or really into a lot of different things like Maya? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You write about not just the, you know, the books and comic books themselves, but also you have an essay about fandom and how as things have gotten more mainstream, we've, I don't know, started to connect with each other and build identities in some ways around our love of nerd culture. How do we get there?
You know, it's really interesting. That's the fun thing to really see about fan culture. You know, I think it's something that we saw really early on with people who are Star Trek fans. Like, they had that kind of really big community that was really active. And, you know, now we see it a lot more. I talk about people identifying with different houses in Harry Potter or different villages in Naruto. There's so many ways to relate to a fandom and like take that into real life in places where you might not feel as included as, you know, a person of color, a person with disabilities, a person, you know, of who's non-binary. That's why these fandoms are important. And, you know, it's great to see that in convention culture too, and how that's changed and how people react to gender bending, you know, doing different types of cosplay for different characters. That's really great.
You write about the treatment of race in a lot of different elements of pop culture. And there's an interesting, I think, question for people. Do we, in our science fiction or fantasy setting, do we try to, or superhero comic, do we try to talk about real world issues of race? That's one way to go. Or do we try to create a society that is outside of that, a utopia, at least when it comes to race, where we can get away from the bad stuff we have in our society? It's a tough question to answer, I think. What are your thoughts on that?
I think Black Panther is a really good example of that, that kind of addresses both sides of it. Because, you know, when we get to Black Panther, it's a very, Wakanda is very insulated. You know, they have been able to advance, they have all the technology, but they're hidden from the world. And they have this front that they're a third world country. But I think that it was really clever how the plot was created, that we have Killmonger come up as a person, as a Black American who was raised in the hood, and him coming to Wakanda and being like, you know, you guys have all these resources and you're not using it to help the other Black people across the world. So I think like that is a really good stand-in for a kind of ideological clash of what do we, especially when it comes to race and especially when it comes to like fantasy and sci-fi, all kind of genre works, like, are we actually representing an escapist fantasy where these people of color can just live freely, or do we engage with the real world, which is a part of our everyday experience?
One of my favorite elements of that you write about is time travel. When our characters go a time traveling, if our characters are white, we don't necessarily have to think about a lot. But you found some examples where Black people from the modern day went into, I don't know, Victorian England and places like that. How do you see that being handled?
You know, it's really disappointing to me because I watch time travel shows a lot. And one of my favorites is Doctor Who. And I see these characters and it's so easy to have the characters be white for that reason. Most of these characters in the time travel stories are white, or there's some kind of workaround so that they don't have to address race. But, you know, it's part of the Black experience. And if you are going to time travel, and if you're going to time travel in America, in Africa, in any of like the colonized parts of the world, that's going to be enslavement and the various indignities done to our race. That has to be part of the story. That has to be part of that character's arc. And to do that in a way that is respectful, but also makes sense to the story, it can be really difficult.
We're talking to Maya Phillips, critic at large for the New York Times, with us today to talk about her new book, Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you define nerd culture? Do you consider yourself a nerd about lots of things in general or something in particular? What do the things you nerd out on mean to you? Are you part of a fan community for something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maya Phillips from the New York Times about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite thing to nerd out on, call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hello. What? I'm wondering why we have to label people all the time.
As in nerd, for example, Linda?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Thanks for bringing that up, Maya. I mean, once upon a time, nerd was a negative thing that somebody called somebody who didn't want to be called that. This is one of those terms I think that's really been reclaimed. Could you talk about the label of nerd?
Sure. You know, and thanks, Linda, for your question. Yeah. I don't think labels are super important. And I think that's part of what I'm kind of poking fun at with my title. That yes, nerd used to be something you would call someone who was involved in something a little bit niche, and it was a derogatory term. And now people will say, yes, I'm kind of nerdy, or like, I love to nerd out about this. And so we see how those kinds of labels can change and how people can embrace them depending on what is happening in the zeitgeist. And I think that what's important is not the label, but just the meaning behind it. And for me, being a nerd is something I just say to let people know that I am passionate about these fandoms, and I am proud to say that I'm passionate about them.
Linda, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Maya, that reminds me of your comment earlier about a lot of the things we're talking about here getting more mainstream. You talk in the book about being able to show up at a major comic book convention without a lot of advanced planning and getting tickets, not something that could not happen today. Why do you think these elements of nerd culture became so mainstream?
I mean, it's funny because we were able to see that with Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood did pretty much all of that work. You know, you can see the shift starting with the Spider-Man movies, you know, the Sam Raimi movies. And then, of course, once the MCU got started with Iron Man, once Hollywood found out that there is an audience for this stuff and they can make these big hit action blockbusters, that they invested the money into expanding that into, and now we have all these television shows, we have all these different types of adaptations, we have, you go across every streaming service, you will find something that, you know, just a decade or two ago would have been considered a little too niche. So now it seems like people can come out into the open and say, yes, I'm very into this. And it can also invite new fans in who may not have encountered this before.
Let's go back to our callers. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Liz?
I remember her referencing Doctor Who, and I have two questions. Bringing on someone of a different race and gender, what do you feel like the repercussions would be? Do you think people would be very upset about it? Me currently, I did not like the current one and the previous male. I liked everybody before that, even going all the way back. And so I'm wondering, how can I break through to that as well?
Interesting, Liz. So this is the character, the Doctor in Doctor Who, an alien who changes a form to be able to change actors over time, for those not familiar with the show. And there's a woman doctor still, I believe, the concepts of changing race or gender for that character.
Yeah, I think it's really, I was really excited when Jodie Whittaker was named the next Doctor. I think she is a brilliant actress, but I think that the writing changed in such an unfortunate way that there was an increased consciousness of addressing her as a woman and addressing, you know, race in new ways, because she has, or at least in the beginning, she had these multiple companions of color. And it just became we just moved too far in the opposite direction, where it felt like wokeness for the sake of being woke. And it felt like being educational as opposed to actually, you know, thinking about the story and thinking about creating an entertaining and experience that kind of, you know, had the same kind of imagination as the previous doctors. And a lot of people blamed it and said on the doctor herself, unfortunately, saying that this is why we can't have a female doctor, but it's not that. It comes down to the writing and being more conscious of, you know, writing these stories for women or people of color. You know, the next doctor was announced and he's going to be a Black doctor. And I'm really curious to see how those writers go back and address his race and are aware of it without making it a whole big deal. Because we don't want another token character. We don't want to have stories that feel tokenizing to the doctor.
Liz, thanks a lot for that call. Peter joins us now in Green Bay. Peter, hello.
Why, hello. Thank you for the presentation. I'm an unapologetic fan of many fandoms. I had a quick linguistic question. It may seem pedantic, but is there a difference between a geek and a nerd? Does that even matter anymore?
Peter, thanks for the call. Geek, nerd, I think that's been an argument argued many times, Maya.
Oh, yes, it has. I actually was thinking about that a lot when I was writing this book. You know, I don't think it matters too much. I think personally, for me, I consider a nerd a person who is into some kind of fandom like I talk about, like comic books, like sci-fi, like fantasy, you know, genre, niche genre. And I consider a geek a person who is into technology, you know, like, and a kind of IT person, or someone who might be kind of into gaming a lot or into computers. But that is my personal definition. I really think people use it interchangeably. People have their own personal preferences, but I don't think it's really based in anything anymore. I think just you call yourself what you call yourself. Like we said earlier, the label doesn't really matter. It just matters what your interest is.
Thanks for the call, Peter. We're talking to Maya Phillips about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. Back to your calls now with Tom on the line in Marshfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you guys today? I came to the Big Bang Theory about during season 3. I'd heard about it, but I'd never watched it before. And the minute I watched it, I was hooked forever. And I like the fact that they used science and humor, and also had real scientists come on the show occasionally, and I was wondering what she thought about that.
Tom, thanks for the call. One of the highest profile TV depictions of nerdery, Maya.
Yes, I also was into the Big Bang Theory for quite a while. My mom still watches it when it's on reruns. And I did really enjoy it, that the references woven into the conversations, they were pretty seamless. And you know, my problem with the Big Bang Theory became, once I became more aware of it and once I was starting to watch it for a while, was the depiction of the male fans and the kind of misogyny that is baked into the show. And I think that is a problem in fan culture, of course. There's a lot of misogyny in fan culture. It can be very... It can't be very, and a lot of times it won't be very inclusive of women. And I think that unfortunately, as opposed to the show reflecting that, the show also had that in its DNA. And I don't think that was fully intentional with the show. So I will still watch reruns occasionally, but I do find it kind of cringeworthy, unfortunately, sometimes just the way that they talk about their relationships and their women. Like, these are kind of toxic guys. But as I said, I already see that enough at conventions.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Chelsea is with us in Madison. Chelsea, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've always loved reading science fiction and fantasy. And I'm very happy that in the last couple of years, we've been able to have more critical conversations about how women and people of color are depicted in these stories. But I've definitely avoided rereading some of my favorites for fear that I won't enjoy them as much anymore. How do you be critical of these stories while still enjoying them?
Interesting question. Yeah.
You know, it's really tough. It can be really tough. I think that you know, I think that you do kind of have to put your critical side to the side. If you can, like, if you really want to enjoy these things that cause, you know, that give you the sense of nostalgia that you enjoyed as a kid that you know are problematic, I think you can have a moment where you say, okay, I know this is not great for this reason, but you can still move on and like go, you can reread it or you can rewatch it. And I think as long as you have that awareness, then that's fine. Like, these are all personal interests. These are all personal loves. And so no one will judge you sitting in your house watching something that you loved when you were a kid. No one's going to do that. I think it becomes a problem when we give more money to things that are problematic, when we engage in a public forum with things that are problematic without actually signaling that, you know, this is the problem with this, this is the problem with that. So as I said, enjoy what you're going to enjoy and, you know, just keep it in mind that some of these things don't age well. And that's just the nature of everything. Even things today that are really popular, we'll find something that's wrong with them in the future. That's how it goes.
Thanks for that call, Chelsea. And Maya, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Maya Phillips from the New York Times talking about her new book, Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. If you want to hear more about the book, Maya is speaking tomorrow night at the Wisconsin Book Festival. I'll be there to introduce her. That's at the Central Library in Madison tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with delicious treats without the added sugar. We'll explore the natural sweetness of fruits and grains for great desserts with the author of the cookbook, Good and Sweet. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, pronouns and pride flags at schools have been hot topics in politics and school board meetings, but what does it all mean for the well-being of children themselves? Look at the mental and emotional well-being of students in the middle of a political tug of war. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we just heard what may be the final public hearing from the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. We'll break down what we learned and talk about where the committees work, and a subpoena of the former president goes next. First, a few school districts across Wisconsin are creating policies that restrict teachers' ability to call students by their preferred pronouns or preferred names without parental permission. At school board meetings, some parents have argued that they have a right to know about big issues facing their kids. Others have said it could put students in vulnerable positions and possibly at risk if their home environment is not supportive. Kids are often in the middle of these political and educational debates, but what does this all mean for their health and well-being? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a debate, an issue in your own local school district? Is it something that's affected you personally as a student, a parent, a teacher? Love to hear your thoughts on this, what you're seeing. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. L.B. Klein is an assistant professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison, specializing in gender-based violence, prevention, survivor advocacy, and LGBTQ+ health. L.B., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into some of the specific issues involved here, the fact that they've become issues, political issues, very heated arguments at school boards and in protests, do you worry that the interests of the students themselves are sometimes getting lost in the shuffle?
I do. It can be so challenging for a lot of the really amazing trans and gender expansive youth in our state and across the country who are standing up for themselves, for every one of those students who is testifying or showing up in a space, and for their parents. There are many more who don't feel safe doing so. And so I do worry about that.
One of the big questions that school boards are facing, this has come up in a few different districts around Wisconsin, is, okay, what happens when a student comes to a teacher or a counselor or whatever and says, I would like to be referred to by a particular pronoun, a different name than my given name, and then what does the school do about that? Some policies say, go for it, don't to contact the parents. Some of the newer policies saying, yeah, you got to contact the parents. Can you talk about what's at stake for that kid who's making that request?
Absolutely. So for kids who are getting to the point where they're telling someone about their name and the personal pronouns they'd like to use, they've already probably gone through a lot of really challenging steps to realize that for themselves. We know that a lot of, for transgender and gender diverse young people, that they're at an increased risk of trauma, assault, depression, suicide, and homelessness. And so there's a real fear around talking to adults about being a trans or gender diverse young person. And so they're already in a place where they're probably feeling vulnerable because, as you mentioned, there's a lot of divisiveness over their ability to navigate the world as themselves, as their full selves. And so that is a huge issue for young people. And teachers, we know, have a huge opportunity to support students that many trans and gender diverse adults really specify that teachers and schools, that those specific people who helped them and supported them, who use their names, who use their pronouns, help to enhance their long-term well-being. So we know that there's a huge impact when we have 75% of trans young people, for example, who feel unsafe because of their gender expression in schools. Those teacher lifelines are crucial.
Now, we've heard from some board members who vote for policies saying you got to contact the parents in these cases, saying, well, you know, parents have an interest in big stuff facing their kids. If their grades were slipping, parents would want to know. If they're getting bullied at school, parents would want to know. Why wouldn't the school be obliged to let parents know, hey, your kid is making this request of us?
Yeah, as a parent myself, I really understand that parents would want to know what's going on with their children. On a broader level, though, what I think about too is that there are many trans and gender diverse young people who don't have supportive people at home. That we know that in the short term, many trans and gender diverse people, only about a third of them, young people, feel that their parents are supportive of them. And in the longer term, across their lifespan, it only really goes up to about a half. We have incredibly elevated rates of homelessness for young people. About 40% of the 4 million youth experiencing homelessness are LGBTQ. When LGBTQ people broadly are about 10% of the population, and trans and gender diverse people are only about 1% to 2% of the population. So a lot of overrepresentation there, and some of that comes from rejection by family. So the consequence of experiencing assault, homelessness, additional harm related to that lack of affirmation at home and at school has real consequences for young people.
We're talking to social work professor L.B. Klein from UW-Madison, looking at school policies, especially those that regard transgender students and other LGBT issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think a school's policy should be in that case where a student says, I want to be referred to by a different pronoun, a different name? Should the school staff be required to contact parents? Why or why not? What do you think? Is this something that you're seeing in your own school district, your own school, maybe your own family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Another issue that has come up, LB, is pride flags in schools. For example, the Kettle Moraine School Board says, hey, faculty and staff, you can't display political or religious messages. Included in that, they've said pride flags displayed prominently or openly, say, in a classroom or a hallway or things like that. What do you think of the pride flag falling into that wider political or religious ban on political or religious material?
When I think about trans and gender diverse young people, many young people in general, but trans and gender diverse young people especially, aren't trying to be political. They're trying to fit in. It is hard enough to navigate school. And what things like pride flags or using pronouns in an email signature or providing information about trans and gender diverse people does is it allows these young people to feel like they have somewhere to go. They have somewhere that they can feel safe. And we want for all young people, for them to not only feel safe, but to thrive. But for basic level safety, it can be really valuable to display support of those students, because in many contexts of their lives, they're not experiencing that support. And some recent research suggests to us that the more domains like school, work, peers, home life, that LGBTQ young people, especially trans young people, feel supported for who they are, the less likely they're going to experience suicidality, depression, anxiety, trauma, that many young people are experiencing who are trans and gender diverse.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Miles is with us in Green Bay. Miles, hi. Are you there, Miles? I think, Miles, you're on the air. Go for it.
Sorry about that. I guess my thought as someone who's working their way toward being a teacher is just like within the field of education, getting buy-in from students and having them see value and a place for themselves within school is just one of the most important things that you can do, just to be able to have kids learning in the classroom. And I just think, you know, using a pronoun that a kid wants or a name that they want, especially if you can tell that they're genuine, that that's like something that's meaningful to them. What an easy way to get kids to buy in and feel valued at school. And like, I don't know how there could be people in the field of education that would see it any other way. Cause I mean,
Miles, thanks for sharing your experience as a teacher in training. What do you think, LB?
You know, when I think about future teachers like Miles, they're really talking about that basic piece around student privacy and affirming who they are. What I want for teachers are training around gender support plans, professional development opportunities to learn about these issues. Because there's a lack of training in education programs sometimes, teachers like Miles might not know what to do. And also we need trans and trans-affirming teacher colleagues for Miles in schools who can be role models and support to students. So I very much feel Miles on that.
Thanks for the call, Miles. We're talking to LB Klein, assistant professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison, looking at school policies limiting the usage of students' preferred pronouns and how those kind of decisions can affect students. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see your local school, say, handling these kind of issues? Has this been a heated debate in your community? Are you a kid who's affected by this or a parent thereof? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with LB Klein, assistant professor in the School of Social Work at UW-Madison. We're looking at school policies related to transgender and LGBT students in general, things like how schools handle requests to change pronouns for a student, whether pride flags can be posted in schools. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. A concern, I think, LB, as we see some states passing laws, Florida most notably, is I think from advocates saying, okay, if we're posting pride flags, for example, are we introducing kids to the concept of same-sex relationships? Are we advocating for them? Some parents not liking that possibility. What do you think about that concern?
Sure. When I think about policy, I think a lot about the studies of state-level policies, that if we have fewer anti-LGBTQ state policies, and there are 13 states that have non-discrimination laws that specify transgender diverse students, Wisconsin is not one of them, that we see that with fewer anti-LGBT policies, that there's greater reuse of correct name and pronoun, and we have better outcomes for trans students. So we know that more affirming policies lead to better outcomes for these kids. And we also know that if we have those restrictions on being able to support trans students, that we're seeing more of those deleterious outcomes, such as suicidality, depression, anxiety, trauma, assault, and discrimination from their peers and others in the community.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. John joins us now in McGregor, Iowa. John, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to tell us about, John?
I discussed this not in detail with a member. I'm retired member of our school district, and there's a real concern that there are some kids who are not really in the transgender and are asking for the pronouns like that. And it's causing teachers or counselors, et cetera, kind of angst over the real feeling that this is something they should contact a parent about. And I really understand what you're saying about there are times that you have a large number of families that are going to come against this. But my feeling is, should there be some kind of testing that's not invasive to make sure that these kids truly are transgender and really do require to have their telephone number and their parents not called?
And John, I want to ask, just to get a sense from what you're hearing from your former colleagues, is it that students are doing this on a lark or as a joke, or that they're confused and not sure if they're transgender? Like, what kind of, I guess, confusion are you hearing from your former colleagues?
I haven't been able to discuss it in big detail, sure, but it's, I think it seems to her it's a joke. Mm-hmm. Or as my former colleague, it's a joke.
Gotcha. John, thanks for the call. LB, I guess, should there be some kind of effort to say, okay, this kid is really sincere or genuine in their request, say, to have a different pronoun?
So I think that if we have affirming teachers, students will have spaces to have conversations about their gender. Being a young person, I think for all of us, was confusing in so many ways. And that's why you have supportive adults who can help guide you and provide support. What I would say is that I would always err on the side of believing and supporting trans and gender diverse young people, that we know that certainly gender can be fluid. Certainly there are people who question their gender that end up coming to a variety of conclusions, but we need to create that space for folks to do so from a loving and supportive place, and not a place that involves saying, this is wrong, this is something that you shouldn't do. And by allowing people to express themselves for the gender that they are, we're creating opportunities for folks to really come to terms with what that looks like for them and what gender means to them without judgment. And when I think about what judging students might look like in these instances, students who are affirmed and supportive, who maybe they think, well, actually, I'm not trans or gender diverse, can then change their mind in a way that feels supportive. But students who are trans and gender diverse and aren't supportive have these incredibly huge consequences, including suicidality, including assault, harassment, abuse, that we don't want those students to experience.
John, thanks a lot for that call. In our last just half a minute or so, LB, what are you hoping schools will be thinking about as these issues come up at, say, school board meetings?
You know, I would hope that schools are thinking about the consequences of any actions that they take to their students, and that they would look into the guidance from the Department of Education and Office of Civil Rights, which provides really useful tools on how to support all students, and especially trans and gender diverse students, that there are tools out there and information to help guide decision making. Because what we all want, I think, despite some misunderstanding sometimes about trans and gender diverse young people and who they are and what that might look like, because a lot of folks don't know, we all want safe and thriving young people. And there are ways for us to do that for trans and gender diverse students.
LB, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's LB Klein, Assistant Professor of Social Work at UW-Madison. We looked at school policies related to transgender students. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it ended access to virtually all abortions here in Wisconsin. Since then, the state has seen protests, campaign ads, and new political groups aimed at organizing people who believe the state's 1849 abortion ban is too restrictive. In a closely divided swing state, the future of that law could come down to a relatively small number of undecided voters, Rob Mentzer reports.
For Democrats running for office this year, the calculation is simple. They believe their position on abortion rights is popular, and the Republican Party's anti-abortion views are unpopular. In the race for governor, Democrat Tony Evers has launched new ads that say Republican Tim Michaels would force a 12-year-old who is raped to give birth. It's a likely reference to Michaels' position when he ran for U.S. Senate in 2004. Michaels was asked then about such a scenario on WPR's regional talk show Route 51. He began by saying he couldn't think of a worse crime than the rape of a 12-year-old.
But I think in the end, what I would try and tell them is, you know, there's a life in there, a life that was created by God. And if you carry that baby full term, there'll be 25 or 35 couples that will be there willing and ready to adopt that baby and love it and raise it as their own.
Michael's 2004 answer is a marker of how deeply held his anti-abortion views are. But 2022 is a different world than 2004. Then, abortion was legal in Wisconsin. The example was hypothetical. Neither of those things is true anymore. Late last month, Michaels changed his position, saying he would not veto a bill that added exceptions for rape and incest to Wisconsin's abortion ban. A Michaels campaign spokesperson pointed to the candidate's recent statements and said the WPR appearance was nearly 20 years old. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June to overturn the right to abortion access was a generational victory for conservatives, but politically, it seems to have helped Democrats. The Marquette University Law School poll found more than 80% of Wisconsin voters believe rape and incest exceptions should be allowed. About 60% of voters and two-thirds of independent voters say Roe v. Wade should never have been overturned.
It's fine for 50 years, and then you wake up one morning, and now it's not legal.
That's Jill Riesley. The 71-year-old from Cudahy identifies as an independent, and she's voted for Republicans in the past, not this year.
If any woman in this state votes Republican, they are totally out of their minds.
Riesley was one of more than 100 Wisconsin voters who told WPR's Wisconsin Main Street Agenda Project that abortion was her most important voting issue in the midterms. WPR interviewed five women who said they were politically independent or who leaned Republican.
The government should not be involved. I don't want a politician making decisions that I should be making with my healthcare provider.
More than just abortion being medical care, it's also about people having the right to make their own choices in their lives.
I actually feel ashamed that we let our young women down.
That was Jean Bartz of Baraboo, Michelle Johnson of Sullivan, and Mary Fuller of Appleton. None of them identifies herself as a Democrat, but they all say this is the issue that will decide their votes this year. Mary Kate Lazotte is a political scientist at Augusta University in Georgia. She studies gender gaps in politics. She says abortion is not one of the issues where there's a pronounced difference between women's and men's views. But
Republicans in general are much more likely than Democrats to disagree with their party on abortion, on overturning Roe.
And that's why Lazotte thinks women who hold somewhat conflicted views on the issue really could reshape the electorate.
Even if they don't identify as pro-choice or have always identified as weakly pro-life, there's a lot of people who are not going to be in favor of a complete lack of access.
Wisconsin is a closely divided state, and races for governor and U.S. Senate are tightly contested. Most voters say inflation and economic concerns are more important to them than abortion rights. But for Democrats, the state's political future may hinge on whether abortion is the issue that can make independent voters swing their way. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, a political scientist joins the show to talk about today's hearing in Congress on the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol and questions about whether the committee will recommend charges, plus the vote to subpoena former President Trump to get documents and to answer questions. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.